Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment affiliate. You can find us on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Twitter. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Turning Tides. I'm your host, Joseph Pascone, and today we are joined by a very special guest. He's a former newspaper pressman, a sheet metal mechanic, and a union organizer. Mark Bulick is currently a senior editor at the New York Times and author of the incredible new book, Ambush at Central Park, when the IRA came to New York. For those of you who enjoyed the first episode of my Links in the Chain series, which covered the American labor movement, Mark Bulick's first book, The Sons of Molly Maguire, was one of the main sources of information for that episode. Mark, I want to say thank you for coming on. I really enjoyed both of your books, and Ambush at Central Park is a masterclass in investigative history. Besides being a compelling story, the book reveals newly discovered information which helps to explain the only assassination attempt ordered by the IRA on American soil. If you're interested, I highly recommend it to anyone even remotely interested in Irish, Irish-American, or New York City history. So Mark, thank you so much for coming on again. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Joe. Thanks for having me here. It's a real privilege.
Oh, no problem. It's a real privilege on my end, too. When you reached out to the show, I was beyond flabbergasted. I was almost sure you were a robot. So I'm glad to see that you're a real-life, flesh-and-blood person. And thank you again for being on the show. It's really, really it's really nice. So my first question for you, Mark, is what were some of the things that inspired this book, and how did you go about researching this interesting topic?
Yeah, the new book is very much an outgrowth of my first book. Somebody posted a review on Amazon recently that described it as a spiritual successor to my first book, and that's actually very true in a couple of different ways. For one thing, both books are about Irish rebel gunmen in America. But beyond that, Ambush at Central Park actually got started as the result of a review for The Sons of Molly Maguire. The reviewer mentioned a book about Cork in the Irish War for Independence 100 years ago. And when I picked up that book, I was thunderstruck by this one sentence mention of the Irish Republican Army shooting an informer in New York City in 1922. And I had read a lot about the Irish Revolution, but I had never heard of the IRA actually conducting, you know, an ambush in the United States. As you mentioned, I work for the New York Times, so I have access to our electronic archive. And when I looked it up, there it was, splashed all over, you know, the front page on April 14th, 1922. And it was on the front page of a lot of other New York newspapers. It was a huge story at the time, but it's been almost totally forgotten in New York. In terms of, like, you know, how I researched it, you know, I started with the newspaper accounts because they were very easy for me to get. But then I needed to start looking for more information. And to my immense joy and amazement, I discovered online a detailed first-person account of the shooting. And everything that led up to it and everything that followed it by one of the three IRA men who were sent to New York to Kill the Informer. The Irish government had sent around military historians in the 1950s to interview former IRA members about their experiences during the War for Independence. And the trigger man in the New York shooting, Danny Healy, was one of the people who was interviewed. And he actually described like what he was thinking as the ambush took place. So like you're inside the gunman's head. It was pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. And it's all online. You know, the Irish government had digitized this archive. And once I read his statement, I knew there was a book in this.
Oh, yeah, I was just saying, it's such an incredible story. And it's like you were saying, it was a very well documented incident at the time. And it just shows how news sort of falls off over generations, and some events are completely forgot, and other events are completely blown up by history after the fact. And it's just so interesting that this was one of those that was completely forgotten.
Yeah, in New York. And they still talk about it in Cork, but they don't have it all quite right. It's turned into a legend in Cork. But as legends go, you know, they get passed down from generation to generation, and things get changed. And so it was really interesting to kind of sort out the facts from the legend. One of the things that amazed me as I was researching it was that, you know, the Irish government had redacted about a page from Danny Healy's statement when they first took it back in the 50s. And it was the page where he described actually pulling the trigger. And the government had redacted it because he was still alive. A lot of other people involved were still alive. And if they had ever come to the United States, they could have conceivably gotten in some trouble. So I thought, oh man, I really want this redacted portion. And I sent an email to the Irish Military Archives saying, look, I get why you redacted this back in the 50s, but everybody's been dead for, you know, decades now. And is there any chance I'd be able to get the redacted portion? And having been a newspaper man for decades and been through any number of information requests to various governments, I figured the answer was going to be either no, or fill out these 15 forms and send us $800 and we'll get you an answer, you know, in 9 months or something like that.
Yeah.
But the next morning I woke up and I poured myself a cup of coffee and I looked at my phone and there was the redacted portion. I had never seen any government react that quickly to a request for information. And there was a little
note
from the archivist in Dublin saying, you know, you're absolutely right. And we've been planning to unredact a lot of this stuff. So I'm happy to do it in this case. And here it is. And I thought, God bless the Irish archives. If there are any budding historians out there, my advice to you is this: always be really nice to the archivists and make friends with the archivists, because they will make your life very easy if they like you. Yeah.
Or they could ruin your life if they don't like you.
Yeah. There was some stuff that wasn't online that was in archives in Dublin that I really wanted to get to, but I was doing a lot of this work during COVID shutdown, and I just couldn't get to Ireland. I mean, you know. So at one point, I sent an email to the history department at University College Dublin and said, hey, if you have any like graduate students there who want to earn a few extra bucks, I could use somebody.
Send them my way.
Yeah. I just need someone to look up these documents, and here's, you know, the file numbers, and just take pictures of them and send me the photos of the documents. So I ended up doing that a couple of times, and it worked out really well.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing, and it just shows a intense amount of initiative on your part, and the immense amount of grunt work that you did to, or siphoned off the grunt work to other people that you did to get this book researched and completed, and it makes such a lurid and evocative tale for those reasons, because it is so meticulously researched, and you can, it does really feel like you're in the room with these revolutionaries. And you mentioned before about legend and mysticism, and this is a great segue into one of my next questions. So in both your books, you tell incredibly personal stories. In your last book, you told the individual stories of someone like Jack Kehoe and his involvement in the Molly Maguire movement. In this one, you're talking about Cruxy O'Connor's and his personal story go against his own brothers and his own countrymen. At the same time, you're able to interweave these personal stories into much grander political narratives. But also, you call back to the Irish roots of mysticism and ancient pagan rituals and things like this. Is this something that happens naturally in your writing, or is this something that's sort of integral to any start of look into Irish history?
Not necessarily, but the real impetus for my first book, The Sons of Molly Maguire, was the realization that there was this like insane link between the Molly Maguires in Ireland, who got started there around the time of the potato famine, and the Mummers, who were these groups who for generations had been putting on like a traveling play around Christmas time. The Mollies dressed like the Mummers in these weird outfits, women's clothes, straw clothes, white face. They were active the same time of year in the same parts of Ireland. They did some of the same sorts of things. They would, like, in the case of the Mummers, they would collect money to throw a party that the whole community would be invited to. In the case of the Molly Maguires, they would collect money to like kind of help the starving during the potato famine. Even the name, Molly Maguire, sounds like the names of some characters in the Mummers play. The Mummers used all these themes from ancient Irish mythology, like dead men rising to fight again, and men enacting vengeance dressed in women's clothing, and the mythical black pig and its role in Irish rebellions. So, if you're going to write about the origins of the Mollies, the Molly Maguires, you have to write about the Mummers, and if you're going to write about the Mummers, you have to kind of put them in the context of all this old folklore that the Mummers like kind of consciously made reference to in their folk drama. So it kind of just, I guess it just kind of happened organically. And the amazing thing to me, having been raised just outside Philadelphia, in eastern Pennsylvania, we have Mummers in Philadelphia. They parade up Broad Street in this gigantic, crazy parade every New Year's Day. And we had Molly Maguires, in eastern Pennsylvania. And when I tried to explain to people, my friends from the Philadelphia area, that there was actually a connection between the Mummers and the Molly Maguires, they would look at me like I had two heads, because everybody in Philadelphia and in eastern Pennsylvania thinks they know what the Mummers are about, and they think they know what the Molly Maguires were about, but they never considered the possibility that there could be any overlap. But I just kind of had to get into all that old mythology to explain the Mummers, and I had to get into the Mummers to explain the Molly Maguires.
In your book Ambush at Central Park, you mention a litany of incredible side characters. Each one is more fascinating than the last. they range the gamut. They're double spy widows. They're gun running union organizers. If you could have a one-on-one conversation or a drink or anything with any one of these characters, who would it be and why?
That's a really good question, and it's a very tough question. And I think it would come down to either our main character, Cruxy O'Connor, who kept flipping sides. You know, he started out as a spy for the British, and then he, you know, joins the Irish Republican Army and stops reporting in to the British. And then he gets caught with a gun as he's heading to church on Sunday, and he's going to be facing execution unless he talks. So he flips and gives away the location of a safe house and gets six IRA men killed, including his next door neighbor. So this guy keeps flipping back and forth, and I think I have figured out why he did what he did. But I would love to be able to talk with him. But a very close second is Joe Marchmont, who is this just fascinating character. She is young and beautiful and ruthless and very, very lethal. She gets at least 9 people killed while she is working as a spy for the Irish Republican Army in the heart of British headquarters in Cork. She is just an absolutely fascinating character. She's working for 2 different spy masters, the IRA, the head of IRA intelligence in Cork, who she ends up marrying, but her day job is working directly for the head of British intelligence in Cork.
Yeah, and it's such an amazing story. I'm surprised this hasn't won like 6 Oscars yet.
And I think of the 3 of them, she's the real spy master. She has both of those guys wrapped around her little finger. She just gets what she wants, you know? So she is just, she's just a tremendous character. And fascinating. Yeah.
I agree with you. I think she's one of the more interesting characters I've ever read about, full stop, period. Would you say you've been influenced by some of your favorite writers and some of your favorite writing styles? Obviously, you're very interested in investigative journalism. You're very interested in thrillers. I understand your favorite book is The Last Good Kiss. would you say... do you feel a little bit like that, what is his name, Detective Shugru?
those books are all among my favorite. There are several of them. And they're all kind of like detective stories. And I'm trying to remember the author's name. James Crumley. That's it. James Crumley. Crumley's just a fantastic writer who, The Last Good Kiss was just one of several books that he did. And I have almost everything that he's written. In terms of, you know, but I'm not writing fiction. You know, I'm writing history/true crime. But I wanted it to sound conversational. Particularly with the second book, I would read passages out loud just to make sure they sounded conversational. And that was the result of, they had turned my first book into an audio book. And I realized that there was a good chance that that would happen with Ambush. So I wanted it to be something that was not only fun to read, but was like easy to listen to. There was a guy named J. Bowyer Bell who wrote a groundbreaking history of the Irish Republican Army called The Secret Army. And it wasn't academic at all in terms of, I mean, it was very well researched, but the language was not academic. It was very conversational. And that was kind of like an eye opener for me. Like, oh, you can write conversational sounding history. And particularly with Ambush, I mean, some of the quotes in the book were like so 1920s-ish, like, you know, the union leader slash gun runner on the docks of New York who tried to smuggle the 500 Tommy guns into Ireland. You know, one of the people who worked with him was saying, like, you know, he pissed off some of the people he was associated with, and one of them said, was quoted as saying, like, that dirty rat, we should have bumped him off, you know. And like, when you've got quotes like that, you kind of like want to write the rest of the book kind of like hard-boiled history, you know.
That's funny. There are so many good lines in the book, and it's almost shocking to understand that they were spoken by actual people. It's sort of like when you watch like a Muhammad Ali interview. It's like, this was a real person. This wasn't like a big choreographed thing that he wrote down beforehand. He just woke up and started saying stuff like this. Like, and there were plenty of characters like that in Ambush, and also in The Sons of Molly Maguire, where they say such intense, down to earth, human things that you could imagine someone saying it today. They're just saying it in, you know, a broken brogue Irish or a New Yorker 1920s mid-Atlantic.
So there was one part in Ambush where there's a watchman and on this boat that has 500 Tommy guns on it, and the gun runners are now trying to offload the guns because they're afraid the authorities are going to seize them. And so they pull up on it with alongside on a tugboat or a motor launch, and the guard threatens to blow them all to Davy Jones's locker, which was such a ridiculously funny quote. It sounds like something out of the 1700s that I, like, when I used that quote in the book, I put in parentheses immediately afterwards, he actually said that.
you gotta let people know, just so they're clear that you're not just taking poetic license of history. So we mentioned, growing up in Eastern Pennsylvania in the Anthracite region. You mentioned in your first book a really harrowing story of how you lost a relative in the mines. This story will always stick with me. I don't think that anything has been more tough to read than that introduction. It was really beautiful and touching at the same time. And it hits home to me personally because I lost a great uncle, who I never met either, in the sulfur mines of Sicily. For those who aren't aware, Sicily, it was one of the great exporters of sulfur throughout the 19th century. I think like most of the sulfur in Europe at the time was being exported from Sicily. And he grew up, and my grandparents grew up in a very hard scrabble sulfur mining town. And he passed away in these same mines. With that in mind, why do you think there's so few depictions of mining or miners in the media? Is it just like too scary? Is it like just the inherent fear of the dark and of small spaces?
I wish I had a good answer for you on that one. As a nation, we seem to be fascinated by the rich and the famous, and especially the rich. You know, I mean, back in the 80s, you had like the TV show Dallas with Larry Hagman, you know, rich Texas oilman. Now you've got like Succession and Yellowstone. People just love to watch and read books about the rich. And it kind of makes me crazy. You know, you even had, you know, there were on my mom's side of the family, there were five generations of mine workers in Schuylkill County, Pennsylvania, in the anthracite.
Wow.
And just a few miles from where they were working in the mines, you had one of the more famous novelists of the 20th century was growing up, John O'Hara. And he wrote a ton of books, many of which got turned into like big movies, like Pal Joey with Sinatra, Butterfield 8 with Elizabeth Taylor, From the Terrace with like Paul Newman. He wrote a lot of books, and he was Irish American, but he almost never wrote about the lives of the ordinary miners who were like all around him in Pottsville. He focused on, you know, the rich and the powerful. And it makes me crazy. I can't explain it. All I can kind of do is, with the stuff that I write, I try to focus on ordinary people and see where it goes. There were actually a lot of a lot of the Italian immigrants in the anthracite region came from the sulfur mines of Sicily.
Okay, I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. With our connection to the mining industry, my fiance's grandfather is from the Czech Republic, or Czechia, as it's called today.
Yeah.
He worked in these same mines, so he may have worked alongside your ancestors. I just think that it's so crazy that all these things sort of come together.
Right. They brought in lots of different nationalities. Bulik is a, my grandparents were from Slovakia. But the mine owners would bring in different nationalities and try to pit them against each other. So that's why you ended up with, all kinds of different nationalities in the anthracite region of Pennsylvania. You've got Irish and Italian and Polish and Slovak and, you know, you name it.
Yeah, and you do a great job of explaining that towards the end of your first book. You mentioned how much the population of Schuylkill County has changed over the course of this story. And by the end of the 19th century, it's basically unrecognizable from the generation previous.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say now there's a lot of Hispanic immigrants moving into the anthracite region. So like that whole process is continuing.
So back to Ambush at Central Park. Do you think that there was anything Crocio Cox could have done to escape his reviled image with the IRA without him, you know, being massacred?
Probably. There's no figure in Irish history more hated than the informer. Irish history is like a history of one rebellion, one failed rebellion after another. And often the reason the rebellions failed was because there were, you know, informers. Which is kind of why, you know, everybody talks about Omerta and Sicily, but Ireland has its own version of that, which comes down to whatever you say, say nothing. The only thing he could have done is like not taken a gun to mass on Sunday. If he had not done that,
such a bad idea.
If he had not done that, he would not have been caught in a police cordon. And you know, there was martial law in effect in Cork at the time, so that if you were a civilian caught with a gun, you would be court-martialed and shot. And they had just performed the first execution not long before he was captured. So he faced a choice, which was to not talk and be put up against the wall and shot, or to talk. And he talked. Once he was in that situation, it was one or the other. You either talked or you, you know, ran the risk of being shot. So,
and in this case, he ran the risk of being shot anyways.
Right, right. And they tried very hard and in many places to get him. One of my favorite stories is the poison scheme. After he gave away the safe house and got six of his comrades killed, the IRA was determined to get him. And I am indebted to a professor at University College Cork, John Borgovina, who is an expert on Cork in the 1920s and this era. And I'd been in touch with him, and he'd been very helpful. And at one point, he reached out to me and sent me an email and said, "Mark, they have just put the pension applications for former IRA members online, and there's one you have to check out, Ethel Cuthbert." And so I looked this up online, and in her pension application, this woman who at the time in 1922 was Ethel Condon, described in detail her role in a plot to poison Proxy O'Connor, the informer, while he was safely ensconced in the heart of British power in Cork, in Victoria Barracks, where he was being held for his own protection. And the IRA, which had a fantastic intelligence service in Cork, had the barracks under surveillance, and they realized that his mother was bringing him a home-cooked meal every day. So they cook up their own plan to bring him a meal. The quote was, "The meal had enough strychnine to poison a regiment." And they had to have someone then imitate his mother to deliver this poisoned meal to Victoria Barracks. So they got a woman, Ethel Cuthbert, who dressed up as Proxy O'Connor's mother with an old shawl over her head, and they found a basket just like the basket that Mrs. O'Connor used. And so she goes in pretending to be Mrs. O'Connor to deliver this poisoned meal, and she has to wait until the guards give her back the basket, and then she leaves. But as she is leaving, as she's heading out the gate of Victoria Barracks, who does she see marching up the other side of the sidewalk but the real Mrs. O'Connor? Because for this to work, the IRA had to detain the real Mrs. O'Connor to prevent her from showing up at the wrong time and foiling this carefully laid plan. But the IRA squad that was supposed to detain her was no match for Mrs. O'Connor. She had lost like two sons already to various childhood diseases and things. She wasn't going to lose her son, Proxy. So she broke loose, and the IRA squad couldn't stop her. She marched off to the barracks and got there just in time to prevent her son from eating the meal with enough strychnine to poison the regiment. Mm-hmm. It's just this amazing story.
Yeah, it's so cinematic the way she's the one woman is leaving as the real mother walks in. like 30 seconds away from utter pandemonium taking place, and probably another minute away from this guy being splayed out on the floor, coughing up all kinds of things.
But they tried to kill him then. After that, the British decided they needed to get him out of Cork, so they were going to put him on a train at Blarney Station. The IRA sent a squad of guys to the train station there. So then they had to get him out, dressed as a sailor on a destroyer. And they sent him to London. The IRA sent a couple of Danny Healy and another guy to London to get him there. So he had to leave Britain. He had to get on a boat and come to New York. And then they sent three guys after him to New York. They were not about to let up.
And they trail him until he can't be trailed anymore. And eventually, it's his connection to his family, which is what you mentioned in the book, that ultimately betrays his hiding spots.
Yes. The way they tracked him in London was that he was sending letters from London to his family in Cork. The IRA had, I mentioned that they had a tremendous intelligence service in Cork. They had the post office thoroughly infiltrated. So they would see the mail to his family before his family saw it. So they knew where he was in London. And then after he left for America, his family was told to get out of Cork. After all, one of the men he had killed was his next door neighbor, Willie Deasy. So can you imagine trying to just keep living in your home after your son has betrayed his country and gotten the next door neighbor and five other guys from the neighborhood killed? These IRA units were all based on the neighborhood. So everyone knew each other, and it was all very personal. So the family had to get out. The IRA told them, get out of town. So they later took a boat to America. And our favorite IRA spy, Jo Marchment, had her sister on the same boat as them. And so they managed to track him to the United States and New York, and they finally they had his they knew his place of employment. He was working in a department store in New York and was spotted, and the IRA was told what department store. B. Altman, he was the department store. And so these guys started staking out the department store. But you know, when they didn't have a lot of experience of like staking people out, and what they didn't realize is that, like, yeah, you need to look for the guy you're after, but you also have to make sure that you're not seen by the guy you're after. So Prussian spotted them and stopped going to work. And then they had to like kind of start from scratch. It took them a while to figure out that maybe they should go to his last known address and see if he had left the forwarding address. Some people in Cork have suggested that these three guys, having just, you know, lived through the Irish War for Independence, perhaps were enjoying life in New York to the fullest and learned out to, you know, conduct the speediest of searches, because if they found him and shot him, like, you know, a week after they got there, they wouldn't have an excuse to hang around anymore. They'd have to go back to Ireland. That's
There you
interesting.
go. I mean, you may as well get a vacation out of it. So we've talked a lot about Jo Marchment and a little bit about her husband, Florio Donahue. I think we're both in agreement that they're two of the most interesting characters in this whole story. And I never truly considered that she was playing both sides of the fence. which is something that you sort of imply in your book. But how exactly did her and her child end up reconnecting? Did the war just end and he was just like, here you go, here's the kid again? During the war, was he like under like a church or something and she like came and visited him? How did that work?
She had, I'll just give the backstory on Joe and the child and the kidnapping case. Joe, the reason she ended up spying for the IRA was that she was a pretty unlikely spy. Her father had been a policeman, a head constable, so he was, you know, the whole family was raised with money from the British government. She married an Englishman who joined the British Army in World War I. His family was Protestant. Her family was Catholic. They kept the marriage secret from both families for a while. But then when he joined the army and got shipped out, they needed to, you know, kind of come clean with the families. And there was probably a religious dimension there. His family would not have been crazy about him marrying a Catholic. Her family probably would not have been crazy about her having married a Protestant. But when he goes off to the army, they have to let the parents know. And then they end up having two children. The husband gets killed in the war in France, in one of those ridiculous, pointless, you know, charges from the trenches. And she is left a widow and wants to move back to Ireland and gets into a custody fight with her in-laws because her husband has left a will that says he wants his children raised as Protestants. And so she gets into a custody fight with her her dead husband's family, and they win. Her child is, her oldest son is taken away from her, and she's lost her son to Britain. And so she moves back to Ireland with her youngest son, and her oldest son is staying in Wales with her in-laws. All legal redress, she has no further legal redress. She's been advised that if she appeals, she's going to lose. But in Cork, in 1919, there are other means of redress, namely the Irish Republican Army. So essentially, she makes a deal with the IRA, because by now she's working as the chief clerk in British military headquarters in Cork. And she cuts this deal with the IRA, whereby she will provide military intelligence if they kidnap her son from Wales, which they do. Her contact and the IRA spymaster in Cork, Flory O'Donoghue, handles it personally, goes over there, kidnaps the son, brings him back, but they can't just hand the child over to her because this is like a spectacular kidnapping case. They're writing about it in the British press. Scotland Yard detectives are showing up in Cork looking for this kid. It's known that he was kidnapped by gunmen with Irish accents. So the child is sent to live with her sister out in the countryside and remains with the sister until the Irish War for Independence ends with a treaty with the English or with the British. And then the child goes to, she goes and collects the child. And
Okay.
That's what happened there, yeah. And her and Flory have several other children. And I think most of them, if not all of them, ended up moving to England. in when they when they grew up, for, you know, career opportunities.
Wow, interesting. So they end up going back anyways, full circle.
Right, right.
Speaking of the larger political struggle between the Irish rebels and Great Britain, at what point did the British realize they couldn't truly hold on to Ireland unless they, you know, basically leveled the entire infrastructure of the place? And when did pro-treaty forces realize that they wouldn't get Ulster in this final package?
Yeah, good question. It's, I think it's, you know, basically the summer of 1922 when the British realized that, you know, they, what it would take to hold Ireland for the crown would be, you know, the kind of like wholesale slaughter that they had just been engaged in France in World War One. I mean, they've it's just 4 years after the end of this, the bloodiest conflict that Europe has ever known, that Britain has ever known. There is simply not the stomach to go through that again, and in a part of the British Isles, essentially. Mm-hmm. You know, there were a lot of very close connections, obviously, between Ireland and England and Scotland. You know, landlords in Ireland had townhouses in London. There were a lot of Irish Catholics who had gone into the colonial service for the British government. You know, it was a part of Britain for, you know, hundreds of years, despite much resistance. But there was no stomach on the part of the government in London to make Great Britain go through the kind of sacrifices that would be required to keep Ireland. And they knew that if they did level the place, what would they be ruling, you know?
Yeah.
So I'd say the summer of 22. And as for when the pro-treaty forces realized that they wouldn't be able to hold on to Ulster, I think that had penetrated the consciousness of the more astute ones, probably in the summer of 1922, if not before. Certainly by December of 22, mm-hmm. when Michael Collins signed the treaty to end the war. He signed it in London. He had been sent there by De Valera. Everyone had thought that, you know, De Valera, as the head of the Irish state, would be the one who would be doing the negotiating. But he insisted on remaining behind and sending Michael Collins, who had been the effective leader, like the military leader of the Irish Revolution. And he signed the treaty in, along with others, in 1922. You know, there's that famous and incredibly eloquent quote from him about the moment when he signs the treaty, and he says, you know, when you have sweated, toiled, had mad dreams, hopeless nightmares, you find yourself in London's streets, cold and dank in the night air. Think, what have I got for Ireland? Something which she has wanted for these past 700 years. Will anyone be satisfied at the bargain? I tell you this, early this morning, I signed my death warrant. So he knew, even as he signed it in December of 22, that there were a lot of people who would not accept it. And it was a very prophetic statement, because he did not survive the Irish Civil War that ensued.
And he's an incredibly complicated and complex character. It seems to be one of those people who is born for the time that they're in, who is so encompasses all aspects of the place that he lives in and the people that he lives around. And beside him was you mentioned him in passing, De Valera. Am I saying his first name right? Eamon De Valera.
Eamon De Valera. Yeah.
Eamon De Valera. Okay. He's also an incredibly complex and convoluted figure. And anyone who appreciates a good rebel like myself will enjoy him. But what in the end? What was his true failing? Do you think that it was his just inability to compromise?
He had trouble with. He was a fascinating character. Born in New York, his father has variously been described as. No one really knows much about his father. He was either Spanish or Cuban, hence the name De Valera, which is not a particularly Irish-sounding name. His mother was from Ireland, and she sent him back to Ireland as a child to be raised by her relatives. She remained in New York State. So he goes back to Ireland, gets involved in the revolutionary movement, is very active in the 1916 Easter Uprising, but he is inflexible. And I think his main mistake was in not conducting the treaty negotiations himself. I think if he had done the negotiations, he would have realized what Collins realized, which was the only way to achieve what we want to achieve is we have to give up something. And they gave up a couple of very important things. The most important thing was the six counties in the north. They effectively recognized the fact that Northern Ireland would become a separate entity that would remain under the crown. The other compromise was this oath of loyalty to the British crown. The IRA was called the Irish Republican Army. They had been fighting for a republic, an independent republic. As far as Michael Collins was concerned, the way he put it was, we now have the freedom to achieve freedom. In other words, we didn't get everything we want, but we can get what we want in time.
We're on the road.
Whereas De Valera felt that they should hold out for a united Ireland and an independent republic. The interesting thing here is that the Irish Republican Army, in order to achieve this, would have had to essentially renounce the democratic will of the Irish people, because there had been several elections. The treaty was approved by a vote of the Irish Parliament or Doyle, and then there was a vote of the Irish people. They approved the treaty, so you would have to renounce the treaty. You would have had Republicans renouncing democracy, essentially, and essentially, it would have taken a military dictatorship to do what they wanted to do, and which was not going to work anyhow. Well, it seems to me that if De Valera had led the treaty negotiations, there might have been a different outcome. And the other thing was, it just seems to me that he eventually came to the conclusion that the same conclusion that Collins did. He left the IRA and the whole Republican movement and set up his own party in 1927. So it seemed like it took him until 1927 to realize what Collins realized in 1922.
Yeah, that's a really unfortunate aspect of the whole story. I feel like if even he was just sort of in the room, he would have been like, oh, okay, so we can't actually get anywhere with this. Collins was actually correct in the end, which is what he ends up saying.
He purposely kept himself out of the room because he was unwilling to compromise. And he knew that the end result was going to be a compromise, and therefore he maintained his own ideological purity, but it had consequences for the rest of the country.
Definitely. And I never thought of it that way. That's an interesting perspective for sure. And that makes a little bit of sense, I think, with his personality.
Yeah.
So going back to Cruxy and his story, why exactly does this story matter? What about it can we apply to the modern day to, move forward as a society or a civilization or anything, a species, etc.?
Well, we were just talking about like the Irish Civil War, and one of the points I made in the book that was that when you hear the term the Irish Civil War now, you think about like what happened after the treaty was signed, and you know, it was pro-treaty versus anti-treaty, but the Irish Revolution itself was a kind of civil war because there were plenty of Irishmen who were fighting in that war on the side of Britain, who were defending the crown. One of the most interesting characters in the book is this Captain Kelly, who is the head of British Definitely. Intelligence in Cork, and he's an Irishman. You know, he's from County Mayo, and he's a fascinating character. But there were also the Irish Revolution kind of started out as a war between the Irish Republican Army and the Royal Irish Constabulary. And the police were all, to start with, Irish, you know. So a lot of what's going on in this book is neighbor against neighbor. And it's ugly, and it's personal. And lately, we've heard a lot of discourse in the United States because of the state of politics here about civil war here or revolution here. And I don't think people have any idea of just how messy and ugly and vindictive civil war and revolution can be. You know, one of the reasons that Cruxy gave away his next door neighbor is that their families had been feuding for decades. And there are a few other parts in the book where, you know, you see how petty feuds and personal vendettas get wrapped up in revolutionary politics, you know, because people will use either the British Army or the IRA as a kind of like cat's paw to like hurt their enemies. And it's ugly and it's personal. And I think people in the United States who talk about civil war or revolution don't have any real grasp of how ugly it can be in a situation that was different than the American Civil War, because the American Civil War was kind of a conventional war. It was, you had battle fronts, you had battle lines. One side was controlled by the Union, the other side was controlled by the Confederacy. What you saw in the Irish War for Independence was there weren't these kinds, it was a guerrilla war. There weren't these kinds of clear lines, and it was neighbor against neighbor. And in the Civil War, Irish Civil War, it could be, you know, the old cliche of brother against brother.
Definitely.
People who loosely bandy about terms like Civil War and Revolution in the current American context, I don't think they really appreciate what they're talking about.
Yeah, when people talk about stuff like that, I imagine they're just thinking of like Call of Duty. They just think that, the lights go off and that's it, and then you get to respawn, right?
Yeah.
Your legs magically heal when you fall off a cliff, and your ammo comes back after you're done shooting. And, you know, they don't imagine a bunch of dudes showing up at your house in the middle of the night and executing you and your family, which is what a real civil war would be like in any sense of the word. And you mentioned the American Civil War. There were definitely clear battlefronts, but in places where it wasn't like that, like Missouri, it was the same thing we're talking about here. Guerrilla ambuscades and raids, which cost the lives of thousands of people. And in horrible ways, like you're talking about, and I agree with you. Yeah, there's definitely a pretty loose diatribe today when it comes to phraseology like that, and it's something that we definitely need to pull back on, or at least try to understand. Which is why I think the Cruxy O'Connor story is so important. At least try to understand what this actually means and what this will actually entail.
Exactly.
So. In the end, Cruxy is shot, but he survives. He lives out his days, for the most part. Why doesn't he say anything? He obviously knows who shot him. It's not like some big question. Does he feel like personally responsible? Does he feel like he should be punished?
My theory on that is that. The reason he turned informer was that he had to. My theory is that he joined the IRA out of conviction and was a true believer. Now, there, as I discuss at the end of the book, there are various theories about that, and I examine them, and there are plenty of people who think that he was a spy all along for the Crown, even when he joined the IRA and was in one of these flying columns that was out in the countryside, you know, ambushing the British, that he was an undercover spy for the British. And there are some points in favor of that argument, but where in the end where I came down was that he was a true believer in the IRA. He did in fact defect and believed in the cause, and that the only reason he ended up being an informer was to save his neck, and and he picked and chose who he would identify. One of the more interesting aspects about him is that while he was being held in Victoria Barracks, he saw and recognized a number of high-ranking IRA officers who were in there under assumed names, and he didn't rat them out to the British.
Wow.
He could have said, this guy right here is the head of the 2nd Battalion of the 1st Cork Brigade. And he didn't. So if he was truly a spy all along for the British, I think he would have done that. So I think he was acting under duress. He had to give them some names. He gave them some names. I think he gave them the names of people he didn't like his next door neighbor, Willie Deasy, who, you know, the families had been feuding, and a few others, because I got to give up somebody. I might as well give up the people I don't like. I imagine it was his reasoning. And in New York, after he had been shot by people he knew, he refused to talk to the NYPD. He refused. That's not entirely true. He did talk to them. He told them how it happened, but he refused to say who did it. Anytime they asked him, he would just shake his head. And I think the reason for that is that he didn't absolutely positively have to. In Cork, he absolutely had to, or he was going to be shot. In New York, that wasn't hanging out. He'd already been shot four times. He probably figured that Danny Healy and Martin Donovan and Pa Murray, those were the other gunmen who were in on the operation, are already on a boat back to Ireland by now. I'm not going to have to worry about them. And so he didn't give them up because he didn't have to. Maybe I'm being too charitable toward him. That's entirely possible. Maybe he was just scared that they'd come back if he talked, or somebody else would come back if he talked.
Yeah.
There were plenty of ex-IRA men living in New York in the 1920s. After the end of the Irish Civil War, a lot of the diehard IRA anti-treaty guys had to leave the country. Because they couldn't get work. So a lot of them came to New York. Some of them ended up living very close to where Cruxy's parents were living in on the Upper West Side, within a block or two. So maybe he was afraid that if he talked, they'd come back after him. That's the reason I picked Cruxy when you asked me if I could have a conversation over a beer with any of these folks. Who would it be? It would be him, to ask precisely that question.
And besides his just like double dealings, his turn cloaking, he had such a weird, interesting relationship with like sex workers. This is one of the oddest parts of the book. I was like, what's the point? Who cares? Leave them alone. And he's getting like attacked by groups of women as he's walking home, and he's like sicking the police on these women. It was just such a strange, interesting story.
He was the
or
one,
aspect of the story.
Yeah, he was the one who started the feud, because he was on his bicycle pedaling to work, and there were some prostitutes who haunted this street near where he lived that he used to get to work. And one of them solicited him, and he like got off the bike and beat her up, as opposed to just ignoring her and continuing to pedal off to work. He got off his bicycle and smacked her around, beat her up. And that night when he returned the same route from work, she and a couple of her friends were waiting. And this was actually the first ambush of Cruxy O'Connor. They pulled him off the bike and scratched his face with their fingernails and just generally roughed him up. And I think there was a little something off about Cruxy. Anyone who goes out of their way to beat up prostitutes, there's just something wrong with them. They're easy enough to ignore, even if you don't like what they're doing. But then when he joined the IRA, this first spat with the prostitutes was before he joined the IRA. After he joined the IRA, he enlisted the IRA in his campaign against the prostitutes and convinced the head of the Dublin Brigade of the IRA to order a roundup, which, you know, Cruxy led the way, and they got a car and they went around and they rounded up a bunch of prostitutes. And according to a statement by one of the other IRA men who was working with Cruxy on this operation, Cruxy wanted to beat them up. But instead, what they did was probably even worse. They delivered them to one of these Magdalene laundries, which were like prison workhouses, and where they were just put to work, and it was very difficult to get out of one of these places. It was kind of like a prison, and you were like put to work, and that's what they did with these women. So yeah, Cruxy is not a guy, I'm curious about him. He's not a guy I would have wanted to be friends with.
You wouldn't want him around like your family or anything.
No, it was something, there was just something very off about him. And nothing to my mind demonstrates it better than his war with the local prostitutes.
And you said that, you say in your book, this may have evolved, because his name isn't Cruxy. I think it's important that we should mention that. You say that it's literally the crux of the matter. He actually turned in these people, supposedly, because they gave him this false name because he couldn't pronounce Clos de Guerre correctly.
His real name was Patrick O'Connor. And his friends called him Paddy, P-A-D-D-Y. He got the nickname Cruxy. There are two stories about this. One is that he served in the British Army during World War I and won the Croix de Guerre for valor in fighting in the trenches of France. Now, I don't believe that story is to be true. I got in touch with his descendants, and they told me that he never served in the British Army. So, gee, okay. How did this come about then? There are two stories. They're kind of similar, but they both come down to he joined a flying column, which was like a group of 30 IRA men. They were all on the run, and the IRA decided the thing to do if you've got that many guys on the run is to form them into a military unit and turn them loose in the countryside. They'll live off the country, they'll live off the land, and they'll ambush the British and, you know, fight a guerrilla war out in the countryside. So Cruxy joins this flying column. And one story is that he bragged to some of his comrades in the flying column that he was going to win this medal, but he mispronounced it as the Crux de Gurry. And they, you know, Irish being the Irish, they immediately started busting on him and making fun of him and calling him Cruxy. Because he had mispronounced the word. And the other story was that he was reading an account in a newspaper of someone who had won the medal. And again, in this story, he mispronounced it as, you know, Crux Naguri, and they, same deal, they just make fun of him and hang this nickname on him. And yeah, I think that the men he decides to single out when he's captured, the men he decides to name, are probably the guys who hung this nickname on him. He didn't like the nickname. He didn't like being mocked. And they mocked him for all kinds of stuff in the flying column. At one point, he left the column and went back to Cork City to attend the christening of his nephew, and they were unmerciful about that. They were making fun of him for that. He was not a popular guy in the fine column. Mm-hmm. People liked to make fun of him, and I think, as I say at the end of the book, the crux of the matter about why he picked the men he did to give them up to the British was it may well have been because those were the guys who hung the nickname Cruxy on him.
I never thought of that either when I read your book. When I got to the end, I was like, oh, yeah, maybe he did do that, because it was a two birds, one stone situation. You get to escape with your life, and you get to, you know, ruin the lives of several people who you despise.
Right.
And gave you crap endlessly.
Right. Right. And it's just another example of how petty this stuff can be, and how, like, really petty matters can end up having gigantic consequences. In this case, it's the death mm-hmm. of six men, you know?
So, as a Sicilian and a Puerto Rican, I've always felt a real close kinship toward Irish people. Our families and ancestors, we've suffered, you know, at the hands of imperialism, in your case, the British, in my case, the North Italian Piedmontese and the Spanish, and then the Americans. In what ways was British colonization different from these other civilizations I mentioned? Or where was it different?
Well, I could argue that it's not so much was it different. I could say it was similar. I mean, look, we're talking about three impoverished islands that that sent lots of people to the United States.
Yeah.
And especially with, you know, Sicily and Ireland, you have secret societies developing as a result of that colonization. You have a very deep mistrust for authority that contributes to an atmosphere of violence in the countryside. And the thing you have to remember about Ireland is that Ireland was England's first colony. Ireland is where England learned how to colonize. And essentially they did that with, you know, divide and conquer. You can look at any number of run down a list of former British colonies, and there's a good chance there was a civil war there after the British left, whether you're talking about the Indian mm-hmm. subcontinent when it was divided between Pakistan and India, whether you're talking about Nigeria, it was the Biafran Civil War. Israel and Palestine, you know?
Yeah, was, perfect example.
South Africa.
South Africa, yeah.
You know, so I think there were a lot of similarities, actually. But you've got three, especially, you know, Sicily and Ireland are, they're on the fringes, essentially, of Europe.
That's true, yeah. And they were sort of stereotyped that way, like, this isn't really Europe, you know, this is something a little different.
Right, yeah. Right, yeah. Ireland has this other, you know, gigantic country right next to it that tried to absorb it. Sicily had this other gigantic country right next to it that has sort of absorbed it.
You could throw a dart on the map and that country has absorbed Sicily somehow.
You know, you've had independence movements in Sicily. The Sicilian mafia developed much differently than the, you know, secret societies in Ireland, like the Ribbon Men and the Molly Maguires. But I think at the root, both of them have what spawned both of them was a very deep distrust for rule by outsiders.
Yes, I agree with you there. Yeah, and there's so many different comparisons you can make between Sicily and Ireland, especially, which I've noticed and which are called out by numerous Italian historians, for example. Yeah. But yes, I agree with you there. There's not much difference between one colonization and another. Maybe the one specific thing about Ireland was the landlord system there. It was a specifically... Maybe that was the only thing that you could really call on, was like one of the main distinctive factors. But even then, it's like landlords weren't British in India. I'm pretty sure they were.
The one of the interesting things that I ran across, and I just alluded to it really briefly in The Sons of Molly Maguire, but there were actually some... Anglo-Irish landowning families that left Ireland after 1922. And where did they go? Kenya. And some of them, you know, some of those families, like, you know, the grandfather was involved in fighting the Molly Maguires. The grandfather was like a landlord who was involved in trying to put down the Molly Maguires in Ireland. You know, his grandson is a landlord in Kenya who's involved in trying to put down the Ma Ma in the 1950s.
Yes, I wrote, that's one of the, I remember that part in the Molly Maguires too. That was one of the more powerful quotes that you used. His grandfather says they had nothing in their own country and they were made to feel like outsiders.
Yeah, yeah, and it all came down to land. Uh-huh. And if you just changed one word in that sentence from like Ireland to Kenya, you know, it would have it applied perfectly in both places. Yeah.
So what's next for you, Mark? What are you working on next? And where can people keep up with your work?
I've got a website, markbulik.com, markbulik.com. I have not launched on a new project yet. You have to remember, both of these books were written. I have a full-time job at the New York Times that keeps me very busy. This is what I do in my spare time. But I am looking for another project. I'm looking at a couple of possibilities. I don't want to get into too much detail yet. One would involve Irish rebels in the United States. and the other would be a true crime thing out of Pennsylvania. But I haven't definitely settled on one or the other yet. I'm in the newspaper business. We talk about gathering string, which is like you see something interesting here and you see something interesting there and you start pulling it all together and putting it in a file. I got a couple of files going, so I've been gathering string on a couple of possible projects, and I might end up doing both after I'm retired from the Times. But it would be safe to say that the next one will either be true crime or something about an Irish American and his role in supporting Irish rebels in Ireland.
Very nice. Very, very cool. Well, I'm sure I'm very interested in what you're releasing next, and you're one of the authors that you're on my list. Whenever you release anything, I'll be right there to be the first one to read it and write a very well-worded review for you, because I think you're just such a incredible author. And like you said, you focus on the stories that people need to hear, not just that what people want to hear, what's fluff or fluff and nonsense. It's not about that. You talk about you talk about real history, and it's from the perspective of real people, and for that I'll always appreciate you, and I appreciate you very much for coming on today. Before we finish up, do you have anything else you'd like to say to the people at home, people driving to work?
One of the things that has fascinated me through both books is this whole connection between Irish republicanism and Easter and Easter week. You know, so you have this failed rebellion, the Easter Rebellion of 1916. The whole idea is like, you know, the resurrection of the Irish nation, you know, at Easter. You know, it's like there's all this Catholic symbolism wrapped into Irish Republican symbolism there, you know. And then in terms of this story, Ambush at Central Park, the raid that gets these six guys killed because Cruxy is turned informer, that happens during Easter week. It happens on what they call in Ireland Spy Wednesday, because it's the day that Judas betrayed Jesus for 30 pieces of silver, which is interesting. And then, you know, there's this huge funeral in Cork on Easter Sunday for the six guys who got killed on Spy Wednesday. And this really resonates with Irish Republicans, and there's this huge turnout for the funeral. And the British understand what's going on, and they try to limit the funeral, but they can't really. So there's all this symbolism there. And then on the evening that Cruxy gets shot, it's April 13th, 1922. He gets shot around 8:30 in the evening in New York. But Dublin is like 4 or 5 hours ahead. And it's early, it's the wee hours of Good Friday morning there. And the anti-treaty people are taking the very first step towards civil war. It's the opening act of the Irish Civil War happens on Good Friday, when they seize the Four Courts, which is the judicial center in Dublin. So, okay, this is happening on Good Friday, almost 5 years to the day after the Easter Uprising, when a bunch of Irish rebels seized a bunch of baby government buildings in the middle of Dublin, you know. And I think that timing was very deliberate, to kind of evoke the 1916 Easter Uprising. And then, you know, the last part of this is, when did the Troubles end? How did the Troubles end? The Troubles ended with a Good Friday agreement. Now, I don't know if how that worked out. I would love to find someone who was directly involved in negotiations for the Good Friday agreement, and just to ask them, was there any consciousness of, you know, the significance of, you know, Easter weekend, and was the timing deliberate on the Good Friday agreement to end the Troubles? I mean, you could argue that the Troubles, at least the 20th century Troubles, began on Easter weekend, and here they are ending on Easter weekend, you know, eight decades later. So I just found that, all of that, like, to be fascinating. And, you know, Danny Healy, the gunman in New York who pulled the trigger on Cruxy O'Connor's, he noted, it was significant to him that the shooting happened on Good Thursday. You know, he said something like, almost a year to the day after all those boys got killed at Ballycannon. And the interesting part is that if you look at the calendar, he's wrong in that The Ballycannon massacre happened in March, whereas the shooting happened in April, in the middle of April in New York. But Danny Healy's going by the church calendar. When he says a year to the day, he means, well, it's a year to the day because the massacre in Ballycannon happened on the Wednesday of Easter week, and we got our revenge on the Thursday of Easter week. So they're thinking in terms of, you know, Easter week and the significance of
that. Yeah.
And I just found that fascinating.
Yeah. It's so interesting that you know, the dates of certain things play such a huge part in certain cultures, especially with Ireland. That is undoubtedly something that probably is left over from the pagan era. Do you think that is true?
Yes. In that the pagan era kind of bled into the mummers. The mummers were active around holidays like Christmas and New Year's and St. Bridget's Day and Midsummer's Day and Halloween or Samhain, as they call it in Ireland. So you ended up seeing, because the Mon Maguires were so closely tied with the mummers, you ended up seeing the Molly Maguires pegging a lot of their killings to important holidays like New Year's or Halloween, and that carried over to Pennsylvania, at least in the very early years. The very first shooting by the Molly Maguires in the United States was like within a day of New Year's, which is the big mummer holiday. And later that year, a mine owner got killed, and it was right around Halloween. And the people who showed up at his house were wearing costumes, you know. So that kind of like carried forward into the modern era.
So before we finish up today, I was wondering, would you at all be interested in coming back on the show at a future date? You could talk about anything, or if you just wanted to come on and vent your spleen, that's totally fine too. I know, obviously, you probably have a whole bunch of stuff on your mind.
Sure. This has been fun. I love talking about my books, obviously. And I love talking about Irish history and labor history. And I'd be happy to come back.
And whenever you have another book out, my door is always open, or my internet or email, I guess. And you can, yes, definitely. Definitely.
All right, Joe.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much for being on. Thank you. And thank you everyone for listening. Thank you for tuning into the show. Everyone have a great day.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. Thanks for the support and thank you for listening. If you like what you've heard, we'd really appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen and share the show on social media. It really helps us to bring the show to more listeners. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'd also like to say thank you to Movo Photo. We use their sound equipment for this podcast, as well as all of our other projects at Antics Entertainment. They make great equipment at great prices, and we really appreciate that they make content creating so accessible for indie creators like us. Check them out on social media at Movo Photo, MOVOPHOTO. Thank you again.